Good afternoon. How's everybody doing today? Thanks for joining our session, WCA B205. My name is Alfred. I'm out from the New York area. We have Henry and Steve Thomas. We all work for Microsoft as MCS consultants, and we work quite a bit with AppV. So I'm looking around the room, I'm seeing a lot of people sort of watching. Can we get everyone to stand up really quick? Just stand up for a second. Everyone, stretch. Come on, let's go and stretch. You know, the food they have out there, the popcorn, the pretzels. We're all going to leave about 10 pounds lighter. So we want you guys to just sit back, relax. We're going to go through a few scenes of AppV sequencing. So this is essentially around sequencing with AppV. Now,
5-0.
Don't forget your mic, bud.
5-0.
5-0. Exactly. So how many people are running AppV 5.0 in their infrastructure today? Great. You may not get
about a third of the people.
And how many people are aspiring to run AppV 5.0 in their environment? Awesome. That is totally awesome.
Now, actually, those keep your hands up, the ones that's aspiring to run 5.0. How many are running 4x now? All right, so most of those are 4x going to 5.0. Okay, thanks.
So great. So our session will walk you through an understanding of what the sequencing is all about, from a basic process, what you need to be looking to see, all the way to dealing with much more complex applications. So this first scenario basically tells you kind of who we are. This is how we work, you know, and I probably want to take a guess who's who. I don't know.
By the end of the session, you need to know which one of us is which.
I'm not any one of those three guys, but you guys get where I'm coming from. So that's pretty much it. We're going to have fun. We're going to move from person to person. This is a different type of presentation. You've been in a lot of presentations this week where you have one person talking about a specific topic. We're going to jump around a little bit back and forth just to show some level of versatility and discussion around the AppV sequencing process. And what we'd like you to do is hold off from asking any major questions until the end of the presentation. So we have 70 minutes to go. But if you must ask the question, please either raise your hand or go to the mic.
Step up to the mic, yes.
So our primary objectives here is to educate you and enlighten you on the AppV5 sequencer. Most importantly, the process and workflow with the AppV5 sequencer. So what we're going to do first is we're going to review the sequencing platform and the process, and then we're going to ensure that we have all the requirements to ensure that you will have as much success as possible when sequencing an application. And then finally, we're going to get into some a little bit of advanced sequencing topics. We'll explain the kind of decision points you'll need to make when opting to use virtual application connections, to have connection groups, or to leverage extension points, what we call virtual application extension points for integration with the operating system, and also talk about a little bit of dynamic configuration, topics like scripting, and hopefully you'll leave here with a good foundation of how to go about sequencing applications with the 5.0 sequencer.
Great. So the agenda goes like this: sequencing platform and process. I'm going to walk you through just the basic sequence and what requirements are around ensuring you have that platform that's needed. And then we're going to, Henry's going to walk you through some of the successfully sequenced applications, some scenarios he's run into, how he's dealt with it, how he's fixed the problems. And then lastly, Stephen will also walk through some more complex apps. We want to make sure you understand the different scenarios you'd run into. Now, this does not cover deploying applications. It does not cover anything that has to do with configuration manager. You know, we have a test machine. We'll show you how it runs, but that's just part of the launch testing that's required for AppV sequencing.
All right, so as Alfred mentioned, we're going to get started with the platform and the process. All right, so installed versus sequenced application. So the actual benefit of a virtualized application, what are we talking about? We're delivering to an endpoint that needs to run the applications. The end user should be a seamless experience. So what's the benefit of it? So on the administrator side, we vastly reduce the amount of overhead in managing an endpoint. That's the point of virtualization. So we're decoupling the application from the operating system. So for those of you that are not aware of it, we install the application while we're monitoring the process, and then we capture that into a package, which then gets delivered to the desktop, as Alfred mentioned, various methods to do so. So the difference is we're not going to flood the local file system, the registry, et cetera. We're capturing that and then using that as a point from which we're going to mount into memory. Changes in sequencing. We're going to see that the actual sequencing process, as Alfred's going to demonstrate, is pretty straightforward, and not a lot has changed from the 4x sequencer to the 5x sequencer, at least in terms of the user interface. There's a few things here and there. And then in terms of the sequencing process, the majority of the changes are in the actual file system and what's output as a package. Go ahead and change. Right, so local resources, the issues of having applications that are successfully virtualized have to do with testing up front. So the first thing you'll see is that we'll have to actually need to go through a process of doing an install launch test on a client. That'll be your base client and minimize what's on that particular workstation, right? So when we're talking about the resources that we want to apply during monitoring, it's only capturing the actual parts of the package that we want to deliver in the package, okay? And we'll get into some of that as we're sequencing. Dependencies and middleware. Now, as far as sequencing, so for example, right now I'm on an engagement where they're not really interested in the distribution process yet. They're converting from a Linux environment to a Windows environment for some key applications that they need, and we're just going through all the applications to find out, okay, which ones are we going to have problems with. So the process itself is pretty straightforward in terms of monitoring and creating a package.
How long does that take?
It depends on the application. So some of the applications I'm working on right now are from the oil industry, and for example, one was 2.5 gigs large last week. And I'm going to get into that because that was a troubleshooting one that I want to discuss. Yes? Yes.
That's the question.
The question was, is it possible to sequence a series of MSI files? And the answer is yes, and we'll get into some of that in our discussions. Okay. So in terms of actually testing an application to see if it's sequenceable, that's a pretty standard and straightforward process. That second bullet point is probably a lot more important and takes a lot more time to review. So what are the dependencies? What are the middleware? Okay. So what level or what versions of JRE are we going to have installed? What applications depend on other applications? All of this has to be an upfront discussion. Yes, you can go ahead and just start sequencing apps, but you're going to have to be drawn back into that conversation. And one of the critical components of why you want that discussion upfront, and as Steve will get into the connection groups, you want to see how to manage multiple layers of applications with relationships. And that's one of the key benefits of 5.0 that drastically changes how we manage virtualized applications and the interrelationships. So previously in the 4X environment, we're doing that on an application by application basis with dynamic suiting composition. So now we're moving that to a higher level and centralizing it through the use of managing the connection groups.
You're giving it all away, buddy.
Go ahead. Right, so here's one of the first and real obvious examples of what's different in 4X and 5.0. So we see that the packages and the results of the packages have differed drastically. So we've gone from OSD files and the SFT file to the XML files and the AVV file. Another major change down at the bottom here is having the potential for capturing and proceeding with a sequencing reboot. Okay, previously, the sequencer actually stopped the process and did not allow the reboot, and that might have caused some issues with certain applications. Now, it'll actually allow the reboot, go ahead through the process, and once you log back in, it'll actually launch the sequencer again and continue the sequencing process. Go ahead. All right, so we're going to just demo a couple of applications. I'm going to capture one app as a primary app and capture another app as an app dependent on the primary app. And then later on, we'll get into showing you that there is a tool for sequencing with PowerShell, and there are specific use cases for that. And then again, later on, the interrelationship of the applications with the connection groups.
But Henry.
Yes.
Don't we need to tell them the requirements for around sequencing before we move forward?
Sure.
Are you okay with that?
Sure.
So you can tell which one is Mo, right? All right, we're going to keep moving forward. Thanks for that info, Henry. So demo time, let's get going. So first demo. So what we tried to do with this session was to focus more on the engine itself, looking at the process itself, and not necessarily talking about what we see on the slides. The slides are very important, but let's really get into it and see what's going on. You'll probably see the same process happen a few times, but a few different explanations on what's happening. So what I have here is my current lab. I have a number of sequencers. I have a number of client machines, a configuration manager. But the ones we care about that we'll be using are the sequencers 1 through 4 and the client machine. I have my basically all my file storage where my apps are stored are on my domain controller, but that's just for access to the applications that have been sequenced. So little things to think about as you prepare to sequence. Number one, make sure you're sequencing on a virtual environment. And again, for those of you that haven't been heavy in sequencing, these things you may not necessarily think about. But the reason why you want that is so that you can have snapshots and you can utilize. I'm actually going to delete this because I
actually, Steve, are there any situations where we would not use a virtual machine?
Yes. I'm not going to mention any company's products by name, but their initials are Adobe, where a physical machine with a nice, powerful I/O subsystem will definitely reduce the time it takes to sequence.
Thank you for that insight. So, in addition to that, we have limits that we want to, some recommendations that we sort of aspire by, which is basically some minimums. You have to have at least 1 gig memory and 1 gig CPU. But, you know, what we tend to do is push it up to about 4 gigs, 4 gigs and 8 gigs of memory to actually run. That's when you really want things to move quickly. So that's just setting up your environment so that you can have a much more efficient process of moving through the actual sequencing. Your snapshot's also important, and just having reliable services are also important. Of course, this is my virtualization platform of choice, so we'll walk through this. So I'm running this on Windows 8. What I've done, and I've skipped it for you because I'm sure no one wants to sit here and watch me install AppV Sequencer. I have AppV Sequencer, which requires the PowerShell, and make sure that's already installed as part of Windows 8. And the .NET 4.0, which is also available on the system. There are times where you'll probably need .NET 3.5, and I've also gone ahead and installed this because it isn't installed by default on the Windows 8 environment. On Windows 7, you do have it, but you have to install .NET 5.0. And just to show it to you really quickly, just so you're aware, make sure you're looking at this because you might have applications that depend on .NET 3.5 on that system. All right, let's move forward. I'm going to pull up my AppV client package, my AppV client sequencer. And not much, if you look at it, when you first see it, it doesn't seem as if a whole lot has changed. But what we've done is cleaned it up to a point where it's much more efficient, that has a much more easier process of running. And again, I'm going to walk through this fairly quickly. Sequence and applications, we're going to move on to other phases, but the intent is to show you kind of what you'll see as you're going through the sequencing process. Some tidbits to be aware of, options that are available on there are, you know, changing your settings. Now, we try not to change those settings. We recommend that you kind of keep it exactly how it is unless you have an explicit need to change any of these settings. You have your scratch directory. If you have an application that requires updates, Microsoft updates during the monitoring, you may want to enable that option. And you, by default, it has a pen package version to file name. Please, don't worry about changing that unless you really have to and you don't want to have that file name available. And lastly, just the package accelerators. Because some package accelerators require trusting, because package accelerators require trusting, you can have that option to just say, always trust this source for the package. The other two items you'll probably see is a parse item, basically parsing out the locations of where the file structure and the registry structure are looking to tokenize the settings. Did you want to add something about that?
Yes. You can't change these.
Thank you, Steve. So in addition to that, we have exclusion items. So that means if you have places that you want to exclude from the actual capture, you can specify it here. A lot of times we see people that are actually sequencing and don't realize that it's capturing things that they don't necessarily need. Be aware of your application. This goes back to something that you were working on recently with knowing your application prior to actually doing an install.
Yeah, being able to be aware of what should be in the package and then reviewing the package before and after and potentially removing some items so it's not included in the package. You can minimize the size of the final package.
All right. So,
for example, cache files.
Perfect. So let's go through really quick. I'm going to grab my application. I'm going to go to my server, put in my credentials, and I'm going to grab MS Math. And you notice here I have 64-bit and 32-bit. I'll pull it down to my local sequencer.
Actually, that's a good point. Most people are running Windows 7. Yes? 32-bit? 64. Okay.
who's running 32-bit? Oh, man.
There's probably specific use cases for that. So the tendency is we're heading in the 64-bit environment world, and for the most part, we'll default to 64-bit if we have 64-bit applications. Otherwise, if we see we have a problem in the 64-bit environment, we can switch to the 32-bit sequencer and then run it on a 64-bit environment. Okay, so that's usually your first fallback when you start encountering problems.
Thank you. So in addition to this, some things you need to be aware of. You need to make sure that you have certain services disabled that might cause disruptions during your sequencing process. We have things like Windows Defender that we want to have disabled. Now, luckily, I have it disabled already.
But, Steve, do we really have to worry about that?
Yes.
Not really. We have Detectoids.
He's right.
That's correct. So I'm going to go ahead and disable it. Actually, why don't we just leave it running and see what happens here?
That's a good idea, Alfred.
Anyway, so now I'm going to go ahead and grab my application. So you have the option to do a new virtual application package or modify an existing virtual application package. Obviously, the times you want to modify it is if it's something that you need to change with the existing package that you've already created. I'll move through this quickly because I see some of you guys are starting to close your eyes a little bit. All right, so we create a package here. I go ahead and bang, bang, boom, there it goes. Now, two things you notice here. You have Windows
Uh-oh.
Search, and you have a package previously. Anybody know why that is? That's quite obvious, right? Package previously created. So if you've already used that machine as a sequencer, it already knows that that system's been run. You don't necessarily want to try to resequence on that same box.
Not don't necessarily. You don't want to.
Yes.
Okay. You want a clean client to sequence on.
Thanks.
Because otherwise, you're adding complication.
There you go. So.
Yeah, it says it right there. Clean machine.
There you go. Revert to clean machine. So now I'm going to jump over to machine number two. And bring that up. Let's jump to machine number three. We'll come back to machine number two. So I'm going to copy the files back down. Most of it should be here already. If it's not, I will pull it down. go back to the same location. I'll do this.
Obviously, this is something that you want to have set up ahead of time, so it's a real cookie-cutter process. It's already laid out for you, usually from a share of source files, then a destination of the actual sequenced applications when you're done, and that will then be available for UAT testing, user acceptance testing.
While he's doing that, be careful of what you really have on that sequencer machine. Now, for many reasons, you might want to, for the sake of consistency, leverage a corporate image that matches your corporate image, especially if there's going to be dependent software, if you are sequencing for connection groups, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But also be very, very careful of having ESD agents like Configuration Manager or Altiris also running on that machine, because the last thing you'd want during the sequencer is to also capture in the background another application that's being deployed in the background. So,
as a matter of fact, that's a great point, because Steve and I were working on engagement last year for about 4 to 6 months. I forgot. We had such a good time, we didn't know how many months it was, right? And out of the success rate of all the apps we sequenced, none of the issues were due to app B. And three of them were due to exactly what Steve just mentioned. There were client components on the desktop that had issues, and one of them was actually related to the Ica client. So you need to watch out for that, because, you know, can you just roll out a new Ica client across your environment the next day? No. So those are the kinds of things that can happen. So we had a pretty good success rate at a company where not one of the issues was actually AppV related. It was environment related.
All right, so we're going to keep moving forward. If you have a clean machine, this is what you end up with, no errors, and you kind of, you're able to move forward, select the standard application, select the location of the application. So I'm going to go ahead and find that source file, where it's located. And from here, I can now specify the actual name of the path. Now, the virtual application package name, what we try to do is, I think this is sort of an old school way of managing applications and application namings.
Yes, I learned this from my grand old instructor from Softricity, who's in the audience. And you need to come up with an naming convention. So whether you use vendor application, version, architecture, patch, whatever that series of information is, you need to have a naming standard, which you probably already have in place because you're already doing packaging. The other component that Alfred's typing in right now is the PVAD, right? So the primary virtual application directory, and the recommended practice is to actually put in the same string that the install process is using. So obviously, you need to know that before you start the sequencer, so you would know that because you documented while doing the install launch test process.
Okay, say that three times fast.
No.
All right, so cool. So here's where you get to the point where you can either decide to move forward or revert back. Once you move past this phase, you have to start with the new machine because it's going to make it a little bit more difficult to manage that system.
It's not going to use the S word, correct?
So I'm going to go ahead and go to machine number 3, which has that state already ready to go. I've executed the application, and at this point, that application begins the process of running on that system. It executes it so that it can actually go through the process of running it. You have two options. You can do a custom installation where you actually have either a batch file or script that executes the application with whatever parameters or switches you have in there, or you can just run the executable that may have already been packaged.
How many are packagers here? All right, so you're used to the scenario where you start, you stop, and it captures everything in between. So that's what the custom process is, as opposed to pointing to an executable or an MSI.
And depending on the size of the application and the complexity of the application, that's when you have to decide, do I use a custom installation or do I use a normal installation? So I'm going to go through this really quick. We're going through installing it. If you remember, I actually specified the directory that it would normally install to. This is part of knowing your application again, knowing exactly what it, where it actually installs, and ensuring that you're installing to the right location.
That includes other components, for example, add-ins and plugins, being familiar with those directories.
All right, so this goes through the process of doing the sequence. It's actually watching what's happening on the system, looking at the registry, looking at the file directory, making sure it captures it, launching any additional applications that might be required as part of the install. That all becomes part of that component that is the sequenced application.
In 5.0, it allows the reboot to process. The question was, what if there's a reboot? In 4.6, it actually captured the process and continued sequencing without the reboot, the actual reboot. In 5.0, it actually allows the reboot, and once you log in again, kicks off the sequencer and proceeds with the sequencing, the monitoring.
And what's
works very well. One mention I need to make, you'll see the screen say force shutdown if something's running and cancel. And what they tell you is don't force the shutdown and don't cancel. So if you have an issue, you basically need to go through both forks in a row to figure out where the problem was. There's an example where there's multiple things going on.
So there's two, I mean, you mentioned that
repeat the question.
It is recommended to put the path to the application itself, but DirectX is, you know, not the path. So in that scenario, you recommend the heavier application path?
Well, the initial application that you are sequencing, so you have already done an install, launch, test on that, and that's the one path you need to use to identify the package.
In this case, we'd kind of consider DirectX to be a dependency or middleware, also point out that we still privatize assemblies as well, so the DirectX privatizations will also get privatized.
Now, that could also be an issue in terms of, do you want to manage DirectX separately? So again, going back to that initial conversation of middleware, so you may not want it installed as part of that. Now, as you're interested in multiple items being installed, usually in that scenario, it installs it if it does not detect it. So if you want to manage that middleware separately, you're going to go ahead and install that as a prerequisite, so it's not part of the installation.
So everybody with us so far, we're only halfway through this process. Awesome. So the question was, what about when it uses the program's common folder?
It will tokenize that and include that. How many of you are familiar with tokenization? Yeah, and if you...
We're not talking about Colorado.
Right. That was good. That was very good. So tokenization basically makes the application portable. So we don't actually install a common program files. In the past, we used the CCIDL variable. In this case, we now have more modern tokens. And so all the common folders that may be different and may possibly reside on different drive letters in some cases, because you may choose your different values, actual values for those variables. In order to ensure portability, we tokenize all those paths.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, so we're going to move through this because we have about two, three other demos to go through. So at this point, I'm running through the program to manage the first use task, and I have the option of actually executing, making sure I've executed all the things that are required to make the app run, any additional automatic updates that need to be pulled down, anything that changes the license agreement. I go ahead and run it to make sure that it's captured that as part of the sequencing process. Again, one of the things that you want to do is you want to make sure that you know that application, and if you know it well, you may be able to pull off some of this running it through a PowerShell, which I'll kick off as well in just a second.
You'll notice that along the left-hand side is keeping tabs of where you're at. So, again, for the most part, we don't have issues while sequencing, but you want to keep tabs of where you might have an issue if it crashed at all.
Now, there may be a circumstance where there might be that rare, barely used application that may be an exception to the rule, like Outlook, for example. You would not want to start Outlook during sequencing. How come? Right, it will over-personalize, so you wouldn't want that personalization to occur on first launch or to be auto-configured.
Okay, so at launch, you guys saw it come up there. I go ahead and close it out. It moves forward, collecting the rest of the system changes, make sure it's captured that information. And then at that point, you have the ability to either stop or review the settings. For a demonstration's sakes, I'm going to go ahead and continue to customize, because now what we see is the option to optimize it for streaming. It actually says streaming optimization as an option. That basically talks about feature blocks. Apologies. We call them feature blocks, and what that is.
It's to establish the efficiency of the streaming to the client. If you don't need everything up front, it'll actually just put the initial loadable components and then stream down the rest in the background. There are other sessions that are dealing with the actual deployment process. So we're pretty much talking about standalone sequencing environment, but we have the ability to move it out to endpoints through Configuration Manager, and then Citrix has some really good integration with AppV as well.
And what's important about feature blocks is you have to understand how much data you want to be delivered down to the workstation. So if you don't run this and optimize it in a good way, what happens is, the entire application gets transported down to the workstation. So it really behooves you to kind of open it up and decide which features, which functions you actually want to run prior to moving forward.
Not only for the purposes of the efficiency of streaming, also for user acceptance testing. Sometimes what will happen is the what I call the level one testing. So it's, you know, install, launch, test, file new, and maybe a save process or whatever. If you don't have the actual user acceptance testing steps that will allow you to sign off in the application, that's okay. But if you can get at least, you know, 3-4 key elements that need to be tested for that application, that'll save you a lot of time on the back end with the UAT.
Excellent. So as soon as this pops up, what I'll do is I'll just change the background, and then we'll close out and we'll move on to Henry's section. I'll just show the process of actually capturing it and using it to test the application process. It always seems faster when you're actually running it.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It is. I can go ahead and switch the make it a feature change if I need to. Where is it? I'll change it to hot rod because Henry's a hot rod.
No, I'm a WRX guy. Subi.
And then we'll move forward. There we go.
Woo-hoo.
And from there on, it captures, you have the option to select what type of operating system you want to run it on. We're going to leave it as a default. We move on to the next step, which says you can now save the package. But if you really want to continue doing some more modifications, you know, by default, it saves it to the desktop. We can actually say, all right, we're going to continue the modification. And in there, you get the option to see what files are excluded. I won't go into this because Henry talks about this during his piece. But the key here is you have a whole lot of other options if you need to do a bit more customizations. From shortcuts, making sure you have your file type associations identified, and even dealing with, you know, anything that's related to COM objects. Here's the default name that you'll find, the package GUID that you might need later on. I'm going to go ahead and save this up to the server location.
And again, for like 80% plus of the apps, you're not really changing much in that environment. The one that we're going to show you later is shortcuts, because you usually want to manage location in the programs list.
Now, I could have chosen to save this locally on my desktop, which is just fine. Just to skip a few steps, which it would have been easier just to have that file up available on the server. I'm going to go ahead and put the credentials. It's already been captured, so I don't have to worry about any of this. cause an issue, and I can then place it in my application location. Let's grab that, and this is where it actually saves it to. And bada bing, bada boom, you'd have your application captured, and you can move forward with deploying it on your client machine. So for the sake of time, we're going to actually move into the next phase.
All right, so we've already talked about knowing your app, and that's also an awareness of what's in the registry. As a matter of fact, it's really nice is that you see that it captures the registry for that particular app, so you can use that and review that for any issues you might have to address. And later on, we'll get into the connection groups. So let's go to the next one. Switch back here.
Yeah, that's you.
That's me. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So the question is, I changed why can't I think of these names today? The font or skin, right? And I did that during the actual launch process, the launch test process. So what happens is that during the first feature block, it becomes available as an option that I can actually use.
Right. So we have two important things to remember. We have what we call first use task, which at that point we're still monitoring. And so if you're trying to actually create a uniform experience or start, or if you want to just get rid of certain things like help make your experience better, check this, check that, check this, check that. You want to get all of that stuff out of the way. You would do that during install first use task. What he was doing was just doing various things upon first launch to ensure that those DLLs and other supporting code will actually be mapped in the inside the appv file as being part of feature block one to ensure that we don't have any delays once the minimum launch threshold for most commonly used task.
Good question. So let's go ahead and move forward.
Okay, so Alfred captured a primary application, so I'm going to go through the process of capturing a secondary application with a dependency. And in this case, it's Firefox, and we're going to have a Flash add-in that we're going to sequence as well. So this one's already sequenced. So here's the new file system, and we were mentioning earlier that here's the results of the application sequencing process in the report XML.
You're not opening it up in Notepad, buddy. That's fine.
It's just to show you an example. In the meantime, we'll get... Yeah. Get the sequencer started.
So I think the important thing with these files is understanding why they're there and what they actually do. They provide you with a little bit more granularity in what you can do with the application. You see deployment config and user config, which basically captures information about that application based on the system that you're running it on or based on the user configurations that are made that are going to affect the users globally.
Okay, so we have the sequencer coming up. All right, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the actual interface because Alfred's gone through that already. So we start by creating one.
So what are we doing right now?
Whoops. Here's our detectoids. I'm just going to ignore those for now. So here is the add-in option.
So what happens when you ignore those?
Well, you can have a messy package. We won't get into that, Alfred.
All right.
All right,
virus slows it down quite a bit.
Yeah, we're just going through the demo here. So here we're still performing a custom installation. And here's the difference. Okay, so previously you had to go into the options and then expand the package. So here's one place where it's different for the sequencer. You actually just select the local package that you copied so that you can establish the dependency. And that's what's happening now. It's expanding the package onto the sequencer. So now when I do the capture component, for the plugin, it sees the actual application that it needs is residing locally. Right, so it automatically shows you that it has the parent primary program installed. And here I'm find my file. Avoid my typing. Thank you, Alfred.
We work together.
Too much. All right, so there's our package name. Now we want the PVAD. PVAD. I'm trying to read at the same time. I can't do that. Puerto Ricans speak really fast because they're only doing one thing, in case you didn't know.
So right now he's getting ready to process, you know, work through the Firefox Flash. Go ahead.
All right, so that's the key component that's different in the 5.0. And most of you are using 4X, so you're already familiar with having to lay down the prerequisite.
So in what other scenarios would we run into something like this?
Well, anything that would be an add-in component that you want to capture separately.
Like?
Other add-ins, like in Excel, like in, there's a whole bunch of industry-related add-ins. For example, I'm an oil industry client, and they use Schlumberger products for geological analysis, and they've got tons of add-ins that we have to go through and test.
So, Steve, have you had any specific applications that you had to deal with that had the same issue, where you had to sequence them together?
Yes.
Thank you, Steve.
That's a good question. We want to point out as well that when you select these options, these control the workflow only. It's not going to change how it's actually virtualized from an architectural standpoint. Because obviously when you have an add-in, you want to, if you're doing a connection group, you may want to ensure that that base application is actually on the sequencing machine, or else the add-in's not going to properly hook into it. Exactly. But correct. And the workflow, there's a few less steps when you're sequencing middleware, because middleware is not really a user application, so things like shortcuts and whatnot are not really of a concern. It just lies in the background and is used. So.
Yeah, one more question. We'll take one more and we'll keep going.
Actually, perfect question. What about an application that may be a plugin for another application? So this, again, is the upfront discussion that you have to have. And basically, you sit there and map out all your interaction and then establish which layers are going to be categorized for access through connection groups. Some stuff might have to be installed on the base. Some stuff may only be for a specific application. So it depends. However, in this example, which is a great example because you referred to it, here, Firefox has a distinct install separate from IE. So in that case, you would have to have two different versions of it. So, and here's another scenario where we're installing from the actual internet. So I mentioned for IE, you can actually get the executable and just point to it. Here, you actually have to go to an HTML page or whatever page that actually will activate and request for Flash. So additional plugins are required to display the media on this page, installed missing plugins. So this is the actual process that we're sequencing, is capturing the plugin. So at this point, it's no different than sequencing the other apps. It's just initiated from the web.
You're actually capturing it right now?
Correct.
Very cool.
Well, actually, we're sort of capturing. We're doing the initial monitoring of what will be captured. So somewhere in the background, it's taking notes.
So I have found with, in particular, with Outlook and Link to have 100% parity for integration, I've had success. I've had my best success actually suiting them or having them in the same package. Yes. Oh, I just finished a Outlook, Unity ViewMail, Link, Link Group Chat, Symantec Enterprise Vault, all in one package.
All right, so this is what we're actually capturing, which is the Flash plugin. And everybody loves Ben and Jerry's ice cream from up in Vermont, right?
But you haven't captured it yet.
No, it's in the process of. We're demonstrating that it is there. So it has been installed, correct.
All right.
Now I'm finished, and I continue to capture. All right, so in terms of, again, it is a big effort, and you don't have to do all of it up front, but you at least have to initialize that conversation of, let's start categorizing, let's start doing our application rationalization and categorizing the applications for the relationships. If you have any issues, you can pop them open. But this is the information that shows up in that report XML file that we were looking at earlier.
So how often do you see this file?
I only look at it when I have a problem. All right, so now we're doing, again, you've already seen these steps. Notice down here, there's an option to force applications to be fully downloaded before launching. Okay, so again, Alfred was mentioning about the feature blocks. So here we're saying, okay, we don't want to have any of the streaming activity take place. We want the entire application at the endpoint when it's delivered. Again. Ooh, a lot of issues.
So what Henry's doing right now is he's making sure he can detail his application as part of the sequencing process so he knows exactly what he's sequenced and where it's located.
You don't need the mic.
No.
All right, so we went through these tabs. Check out the registry. Package files, if there's any services installed.
So quick question.
Yes.
In what instance would you make changes to the virtual registry or the package files?
For those of you all listening in on the internet to this, we're down to one mic, and we are really starting to look like the Three Stooges up here.
Did you answer a question? You still didn't answer a question. In what instance would you make changes to the virtual registry or the package files?
Broken app. Seriously, actually. There may be times when you're testing the application and there is some, let's just say, the application's not functioning as expected and you do a little troubleshooting and you realize that there is an overlap in what we call registry opacity, where we have maybe a registry conflict between the virtual registry and the local registry. There may be a file that you decided you didn't want to be there because you didn't want that directory actually captured. Those various things, you can easily edit the package and remove those components to actually prevent you from having to resequence again. And once again, when you sequence an application and you have found no resources about sequencing that application and you're actually able to successfully sequence that application, please share it with the community. We have a recipe forum on TechNet, and anyone is encouraged to post recipes. We just have some guidance and recommended formats for you to follow.
Thanks, Steve. So we just skipped on to the steps. As you can see here on the client itself, he has AppV sequenced with the Firefox and Flash running at the same time. And the cows are happy.
It's two separate packages. So it's two separate packages.
So the question was, is it two separate packages? Yes, they are. And the connection groups were used to actually accomplish that. So we're going to keep moving forward.
Okay, so just a quick review of the application assets that come from the result of sequencing. Probably the most important one is the ATV file. That it contains all the files, that contains all the registry assets, and most importantly, the manifest. The nice thing about the ATV format is, as opposed to previous versions of ATV, this contains all of the assets, including the shortcuts. We now have three feature blocks in ATV 5. We have feature block 0 now, which we call the publishing block. And that's where you're going to get the most important things for publishing, like the icons, shortcuts, FTAs. And then, of course, we mentioned the optimized feature block 1, and then, of course, the remaining assets in feature block 2. The ATV file is a modernized format based off the APX format that was backported as well for us to have this feature on Windows 7. There is also an executable MSI wrapper. This MSI wrapper basically replaces publishing with PowerShell, where we embed all of that into a MSI, so you can just simply run the MSI and load the package. What this does is this allows you to use ATV clients in either standalone mode, or if you're using a third-party ESD like Alteryx, you can use the MSI to deploy through Alteryx. And then finally, we have our dynamic configuration files. We have our deployment config file, and we have our user config file. Depending on actually how you roll out the application will determine where you actually use these files. If you're using a publishing server, you're going to be importing this configuration in into the publishing server. Likewise, you would do the same thing if you're using Config Manager integration. If you're actually manually publishing or scripting out your publishing or packaging an MSI, you're probably going to want to add this stuff manually using PowerShell. And then finally, Accelerator, the CAB file. If you successfully sequenced an application, you can actually create an accelerator which will have, along with this and the installation media, and whatever customizations you went through to sequence it, it will turn your package creation into nearly a one-step process, where instead of sequencing an application, you will actually generate a new application using this package accelerator. Another thing I would strongly encourage you to do is to leverage templates. I know a lot of people are making a policy of doing network redirection of the app data folder. Or they're using UEV to roam settings. So they want to ensure that certain settings are not going to get captured. So what they do is they will go in and they'll add exclusions for like app data. Well, if you know you're going to be doing that for all of your applications because it's your policy, then save yourself some trouble and leverage a template. Create a template that you can import into the sequencer so you don't have to go through and use all of those steps.
Okay, Alfred's going to show you the one other aspect of sequencing we wanted to show you, which was with PowerShell. Now, there are specific use cases for PowerShell. So, for example, if you have an application that's pretty straightforward and doesn't need much in terms of customization or configuration, that'd be a great example of what to use PowerShell for.
So, first thing I'm going to do is set the
Yeah.
I'll need one.
Okay.
You can hold it, though. One,
just
one.
Go ahead. It's stereo.
Oh, boy. I'll try just one.
There you go.
All right. So, set the execution policy to remote sign. What I want to do is make sure I can execute this so that I can run any required steps in the process. Wow, that does kind of get in the way. Really cool. All right. So what next thing I'm going to do here is I have a script that can actually execute the math application. But before I do that, I need to make sure that it's in the path specified So I have a source directory here. I have the msetup_x64 file, as we mentioned before, and a target directory where the actual application is dumped to. Now, at this point, you can put in any parameters that you need to have the application executed without going through the actual, hiding the switches to ensure that it actually installs successfully if you have it, or running a batch file if you need to. I'm going to go through just the basic process of grabbing the file itself and executing it. If you look at the command here, I have new app vsequencer, the name of the package that I want it to be, the package's location, right, and where it's going to end up, and then the actual name of the source file that I'm going to use, the installer, and the PVAD. Again, this being very important because it has to know where it's actually installing in the system itself.
How many of you leverage scripted MSIs or MSI transforms to automate? Perfect. This would definitely help speed up that process.
So imagine having to do, and this goes back to the gentleman's question in the front, having to do a number of this through a batch file. If you did it right, you could actually automate it. And I believe there was a session I've seen a few times where some of our internal Microsoft employees have this process where it brings up the VM, has the application name available, and actually executes the process of sequencing it for later use. Now, this is going to take a few minutes, but at the end of the process, what you'll end up with is the same package located in the packages directory. Now, I'm going to jump to one other section here before we move forward, and this is basically having that application execute on the local machine. Some of you may be familiar with this. I'm going to grab this script, which just says, here, rather than running the MSI, I'm going to ensure that I can actually run the application on the system and test to make sure it's actually doing what I want it to do. I'll say yes to execution policy, and lastly, I'll grab the add AFI package. It looks at the directory where the package is located. At this point, it's on my server. I'm going to go there really quick just to make sure. DC1. And here is the source location with the package itself. And at that point, I can actually execute it. Here's another copy. And what it'll do is it'll go ahead and load that package. Again, this might take a few minutes, but the idea is having that as an option to test your application might be quicker than having to go to the server, put it into the AFI management server or configuration manager. This is just isolating your sequencing environment so you can actually do your own testing and validation of a process, except for when you get red marks like that.
Okay, so that was just a quick look at the ability to actually sequence with PowerShell as well. You're still there?
I'm just going to go ahead and execute it. Let's see if I can run it. That's your other option. So at that point, if you can't run it that way and you need to just test it, you'll have the ability to run that MSI. And if you open up the client itself, which will pop up, you'll see that the package is loaded on the system. Just give us a few seconds here, and then we can move forward. Bing, bang, boom. There's your application coming up in any moment here.
All right, time's up.
My time's up.
We'll see you later.
We'll go back to that.
Okay. So what I would like to do right now is talk a little bit about the concept of virtual application connections through connection groups and virtual applications and extension points or integration with the operating system. So as far as evolution goes of the product, in earlier iterations of the product, if we wanted a virtual application to be able to fully interact with another virtual application, we had to suite them. We had to put them in a suite of applications, one package. We introduced a concept in AppV 4.5 called dynamic suite composition, where we would basically take two separate virtual environments or more, and we would create passageways to allow them to actually share assets and to actually be able to communicate through the virtual subsystems with each other. Now, what we've done in 5.0 is we've enhanced this through the use of what we've called connection groups. AppV5, I'm going to use a big word, especially for those of you who have used 4.6. You've probably learned it's a paradigm shift, right? Okay. Now, often when Microsoft has paradigm shifts, we also change, wait for it, nomenclature. Those are the words for the day, paradigm and nomenclature. So connection groups enhance interaction with each other, and on top of that, we have extended the management of connection groups. Whereas in the past, when we wanted to configure dynamic suite composition, a lot of that was had to be done out of band. Well, what we've done now with App V5 in connection groups, first thing is when we're updating the WMI namespace, we actually put in connection group classes in WMI. We incorporated connection group creation and management into PowerShell and also gave the capability to publish and deliver connection group information through Config Manager, like Config Manager 2012 SP1, through the AppV management server as well. So, one thing you'll need to remember is the life cycle when it comes to testing your connection groups. You'll need to always sequence with connection groups in mind. For example, if an application if you want to retrofit applications, that may be challenging if they're expecting specific hooks to be in place. So if you know that there's going to be an application, for example, that you're going to be configuring with a connection group with Java, for example, well, Java's going to need to be on the sequencer locally when you sequence that, or you're going to need to take a virtual package and expand it to local system on the sequencer as well. So once you've sequenced for connection groups, then you have the test lifecycle. And what's nice about the test lifecycle is you can actually do this in standalone mode. You can add and publish your packages through PowerShell. You can add and enable the connection group. You can actually create your own connection group document in PowerShell. And then, of course, you would launch and shut down your applications. And then, of course, you would need to ensure the proper workflow for disabling and removing, especially if you are planning out updates of connection groups.
Also, that disabling and removing, if you happen to go the MSI route, don't try to back out with PowerShell. There's two different distinct processes doing different things, and you may not get a clean result from that.
Okay.
So far, we've gone through the whole process. We're at the last demo process. Now, hopefully, can you guys tell the difference between who's who? I guess not. All right, let's keep going then. Demo time. Let's roll it.
I'm two.
Give the man a beer.
Okay. So?
Okay. Which one?
So here we have a Java-dependent application. Now, this Java-dependent application that I'm actually using is, you didn't see that. I need to get this in full screen mode. There we go. All right. So I launched the application, and of course, Java hasn't been found on my computer. Do I want to download it? No. So this is a virtual application. It's a game. I like testing with games sometimes. Makes it a little more fun. So instead, I'm actually going to go to this demo, which has the same thing. And it works. Now, many people may ask, how do we, in fact, get this to work? How do connection groups work? Well, the most critical component of a connection group is this little file right here. It's a descriptor file. And this is what makes publishing and managing connection groups possible. And the key elements here are, of course, the versioning of the connection group itself, and of course, the key components, which are the packages, and you'll also notice the versions are there as well. So that you're going to have to keep that in mind. When we actually change or update a package, we're actually going to create a new version ID, which means your connection groups will need to be updated as well. So let's talk about what the connection group actually sees. So I'm going to launch a command here. And you're welcome to try this at home anytime you want. You can use this with Task Manager. I prefer Process Explorer. But I'm going to go inside the VFS.
Don't try this at home.
So with the colonization program running, you'll now see that there's free call, which is the executable of the virtual application. And what do we have here? We have Java there as well. Now, if you look at the application virtualization client, there we have my two packages. We have my colonization package, and we have the Java package. And then, of course, here we have the connection group. I'm very creative with my name, as you can see. So there are several ways to get inside the bubble. I'm just going to do one of my favorite ways. I'm going to pay attention to the PID for 2152, which is a PID for free call, and I'm going to launch a command, which is really a command extension. You can run any process as long as you include this hook, appv PID, and then I'm going to put in the PID, which is 2152.
Has anyone ever tracked down a PIV while they're troubleshooting? So at least a few of you know what that means.
And by the way, if you do this with Explorer, you will need to ensure that Explorer is configured in options to actually launch in a separate process. So if you check launch folder windows in a separate process, then you can actually use this trick to bring Explorer inside the virtual bubble. Now, let me do that again, because I just closed it accidentally. And we're going to go to Program Files. And there you see that you see free call. Not in that bizarre appv directory, with the really long GUID and the really long package GUID and the really long version GUID. You're seeing it where the virtual environment sees it, which is the folder you sequenced it to. In this case, I sequenced mine to Program Files, which you can do. And then, of course, I see Java. Java's there, JRE6. Now, here's another kicker here. I'm going to launch another instance of Explorer. This Explorer is local. Meanwhile, when I'm doing this, what do you notice on the local window? I'm going to run these side by side. There's JRE6, and there's JRE142. Yes, there's a local version of Java too. And you can isolate local Java with virtual Java as well. So what I've got here is I've got a specific version-dependent app. In this case, it's FreeCall, and it's dependent upon a version of Java that is different from the local Java that's actually installed on the machine. But through appv and through connection groups, we're able to isolate them, and we're able to get functionality, as we can see here.
Question?
Yeah, you can clap. That's good.
Yes, you can. There's a quick way to do that. You could even create a custom shortcut by bringing IE into the bubble of the specific Java application in that case, you'd probably want to use @v_ve extension rather than the @vpid. This is a good time to promote my shameless blog.
If you go to blogs.technet.com.
That does bring up another issue in terms of the pre-planning, because you need to make sure that you have a use case for specific individuals that need that IE component, because users will tend to get confused about why isn't this working or that working, because it has to be, you know, usually a different icon to make sure that's very clear to the end user what application they're trying to run.
You can also find me on Twitter. I'm a social media junkie as well, mad virtualizer. My son says I'm so bad at social media that I check in from a bathroom if they allow that on Foursquare. But
all right, Steve, we got to keep going.
All right.
All right. So it's on you.
Let's talk about scripting. Okay. So, how many of you worked with scripting in previous versions of AppV? And how many of you are at the same time doing that while learning scripting in 5.0? Okay. How many of you are having trouble with scripting in 5.0? Excellent. Excellent. I came here expecting to do the Jedi mind trick. There are no problems with scripting in 5.0. All right. So, first of all, scripting, there is no more script body. We do not embed inside the XML. Those are not the scripts you are looking for. We embed in the package. Put the script in a command file, in a VBScript file, put it in a PowerShell file, and embed it in the scripts folder inside the virtual package. You can call that script folder with a relative path using dynamic configuration. But also remember, they're not enabled by default. You have to enable you have to enable package script support using either changing the registry, using group policy, or using the PowerShell option. Scripting is also event-driven. We now have way more options with scripting in AppV5. We now base this, I like to use the term event trigger, but it's probably not appropriate because that may be misleading, but when we have events, you can assign a script to it. You can assign a script pretty much through any of the package lifecycle process. And if you look at the comparison between 4.6 and 5.0, it's not directly a one-to-one comparison. There are, let's not think of pre-launch and post-launch scripts anymore. Let's think of events and what event would be appropriate. Okay, so here's a question. What if you need to locally install a driver? What event would be appropriate for that? When you add a package. What if you need to map a network drive? What event would be appropriate? You want that likely when a virtual application environment is built. Those are the things that you'll need to think about, especially if you're using RDS or Citrix. Another thing you need to realize is where you place that script in terms of its configuration will determine how it gets deployed, and also will determine user context as well, the actual security context in which the package is running. So take a look at this diagram here that we crafted that kind of tells you how you're going to need to target this configuration. Now, also understand that when scripts run in the deployment configuration for events like global publishing or add package, it's going to be running under the system account. So you don't want to do things like map a drive during those events, because you're going to be doing it under the system account. You want that running under the context of the user. Okay, so we also want to talk briefly, obviously, because we're running out of time, about extension points. Extension points is another concept to grasp in terms of nomenclature. We used to talk about these things separately, file type associations, shortcuts, shell extensions, etc. These are extension points because these are elements that involve OS integration. File type associations is the most common one. You want to be able to double click on documents. Shell extensions. We have some shell extension support, but we have basic support. COM modes. Do you want to virtualize COM, or do you want us in the virtual bubble to be able to have calm interaction with local applications. Software clients, do you want to register this virtual Firefox as the default browser? While we may not like it, we gave you the capability. You can register Google Chrome as a default browser. We prefer you use IE, but AtV does allow you to do a virtual registration. Mail clients, media player clients, default programs, you can now configure those to be applications.
So, again, guys, thank you for coming to our session. I could sit here and allow Steve to keep going on and on. If you're interested in Q&A, please go ahead and start asking it now. But for those of you that need to run, thanks for coming. And most importantly, you, as you're walking out, make sure you do your surveys. Make sure you do your surveys. And go ahead and feel free to ask any questions. We have a lot of related content as well. So the question is there anything covering updates to an existing package? So in the labs, we have sessions that we have the ability to actually walk through the update of an existing package. Any other questions?
For connection groups, for connection groups, do you have to specify connection groups for native applications?
Well, what you can do is you can create an empty VE and bring that local application into the virtual environment through like a shortcut, and then combine that with other virtual applications in a connection group.
So like if you virtualized Flash, for example, and IE was native on the box and you
right.
wanted to use Flash, like do you still have to specify a connection group for Flash?
Well, if it's just Flash, you can actually just sequence it as an add-in and use IE as a parent application. It just, and since IE is already going to be on the sequencer, it will just create a shortcut to the local instance of IE.
Right.
So.
Awesome. Thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, one more question right here.
Have you had a chance to sequence Autodesk products?
Autodesk products?
2012, 2013. Engineering app for energy, so have you ever...
Autodesk is going to fall under the Adobe category.
This is the Autodesk.
I'm sorry?
Autodesk.
Yeah, it's going to fall under the same category, and I would recommend that you actually use physical hardware to sequence it with it.
But yes, you can run into licensing issues and some of the hardware issues, depending on which app you're talking about.
I'm sorry?
Ever sequence key pass? And
is it a piece of security software? Does it try to? It could be something to do with the cryptography API that it might be trying to extend. It could be trying to put in WMI settings. It could be a driver. Of course, it would tell you if it's a driver. Are you getting stuff from the detectoids, or is it just crashing during sequencing? Okay, all right. Okay. Yeah, that'd have to be reverse engineered a little bit.
All right, if you have any other questions, please just come up to the front. Again, thanks for joining the session, and hope you enjoy the rest of Tech Ed.